Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. For all those new listeners and viewers, welcome. For those returning subscribers and viewers, glad to have you back. Should be a doozy. I'm trying to put this episode together for a while. It will be just me in the chair tonight. The rest of the crew is off, as we'll be coming back in full force this Thursday for a call-in, Ask the Crew Anything show. And those are always a lot of fun. Today, we're going to talk about the Chicago migrant crisis and the Black response. It feels like it was ages ago, but just 6 years ago, during the early years of the Trump administration, the nation was furious at the reality show president's draconian zero-tolerance border policy. Trump, who to a certain degree was a master of sleight-of-hand political rhetoric. It wasn't me, it was your beloved Obama who built those cages. Remember that one? We were all mad about the kids in cages. That didn't work to absolve the Trump administration of their racist campaign rhetoric when it came down to migrants. They were murderers and rapists and coming to take your job, become a scourge on the American body politic. If anything, migrants become pawns for both ruling parties of capital. Democratic mayors were quick to let the GOP know that their cities were sanctuary cities and would be a safe haven for asylum seekers. In cities like Chicago, activists took this opportunity to make Chicago truly a sanctuary city and not one in name only. But that acceptance would be short-lived. After winning some big political battles and transforming Chicago into a true safe haven for those seeking a better life, Chicago is once again a political playground. But which party is winning may be a surprise to many. Since 2022, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has sent over 80,000 migrants to the Windy City. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in attempting to house this new population. But some of the Black residents feel that the money being spent on this new crop of people should be reallocated to the already downtrodden Black citizenry. Black residents are frustrated with the amount of money and, to some extent, the accommodations that the migrants have received. To discuss this further, I have friend of show, Chicago resident, and professor of African American studies. Please welcome Cedric Johnson. Bam. How are you?
How's it going? Good to be here.
Is that a fair introduction? Am I painting a fair picture of the situation in Chicago, or was I too nice? Is it even more upsetting than that?
I think it is more upsetting, but we'll see. We'll see after today. Today is actually an important day in the battle around this issue. Yeah, so we'll see what happens.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join me this evening. It's been a struggle to get this episode done. We were trying to do it actually soon after you did an interview for Southside Magazine. Your most recent book, After Black Lives Matter, discusses the failures and limitations of that organization. Where are they in regards to this migrant crisis? Or are they not as prevalent in Chicago? And then what Black-run orgs outside of the NAACP, because we spoke about it many times on this show, and I wrote about it actually for Sublation Magazine, that the Illinois chapter of the NAACP has not been very gracious to the migrants. But what Black-run orgs outside of the NAACP are speaking out on what's happening? Is it kind of an anti-migrant sentiment across the board, or is it a little more nuanced than that?
Yeah, so I would say in this case, right, the forces that we would associate with Black Lives Matter have been some of the most progressive on this issue, right? So today is election day in Chicago, and one of the measures on the ballot is the Bring Chicago Home referendum. And what this would do is basically change the situation we have now, which is a pretty much a flat tax when it comes to real estate transfers.
Okay.
And it would create a graduated tax. So for those persons who, you know, purchase a property and a transaction is less than $1 million, your taxes would go down.
Go down?
Yeah, it would go down if it's like a less than $1 million purchase. But for those who make purchases above $1 million, there would be a much heavier tax levy. And also on the same ballot measure, it would cause for the use of those funds that are generated to pay for housing for the unhoused or homeless, right? And so this is one of the attempts that I think the mayor has endorsed. It's also one that a few of the most progressive members of the city council have supported. And it's one that's been really advanced by an activist named Asha Ransby Sporn, who is a younger activist who comes out of, you know, anti-carceral activism, comes from a family of academics and activists. And so
abolitionists. You know,
people on the ground here are pushing for that. We'll see what happens. There was a pretty strong campaign against it, you know, mounted by, surprise, the real estate and landlord interests across the city, who were against this idea of increasing taxes on themselves. And so, you know, pretty strong media blast, constant commercials on television and on radio and other places to try to dissuade people from voting. One of the unfortunate things is that, from what I understand, and I haven't looked at the outcome of today's election yet, but the turnout, from what I heard earlier, was pretty low. And they were expecting to pick up once people got off work. But if it's low, I suspect that referendum measure will fail. Mm. But it is one of those instances where we see Black activists who are not, you know, taking a Trump type position when it comes to the migrants, and who actually are trying to figure out ways to address the unhoused population in the city more generally. So it's exciting. But like I said, I've heard stories just today. One friend of mine whose daughter voted for the first time.
Oh, wow.
So when they looked at the paper ballot, it didn't even have Let's Bring Chicago Home referendum on it. And so, you know, Chicago legendarily is a place where there's all manner of chicanery and political meddling that happens, bad behavior on election day. So I just think it's, on the one side, a great sign of what's possible and that people are organizing to try to address these issues and think about redistributive public policy. But at the same time, you know, from everything I'm hearing so far, there's a chance that it may not pass.
It's interesting that you're talking about reallocating funds to the homeless population, because Chicago does not have a large homeless population. The irony of this migrant crisis is Texas actually has a pretty large homeless population,
right,
as does Florida. Two of the mm-hmm. states have been busing immigrants to cities like Chicago and New York.
Right.
But if you add in this influx of migrants, your homeless population is a little closer to California.
Yeah, still, I mean,
but it's a little closer to California. So is that right. What this is also going to go to as well? Are we looking at the migrants also as the unhoused?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Cook County, there may be around 68,000 people who are technically categorized as homeless. And then the asylum seekers or refugees total over 35,000. So it basically, you know, it adds up to a pretty large population of people. And I think this has been one of the slow movement responses. You know, it would have been great if people in the mayor's inner circle, you know, had seized upon this from the very beginning and took what are essentially two artificial crises, right? I would argue that the, you know, of course, the migrant crisis on its face is artificial. It's something that engineered by the right, you know, right wing strategists who wanted to utilize this sanctuary city rhetoric as a way of driving a wedge into the Democratic Party and some of its strongholds, places like Chicago, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so it's an artificial crisis from the vantage point of the refugees and the migrants. It's also artificial when it comes to the unhoused. I mean, these are issues that can be addressed, right? I mean, the fact that people don't have housing is not a natural state of affairs. It is an outcome of a society where we treat housing as a commodity, and where we've invested a tremendous amount of money over the last, 100 years, essentially, to make sure that the idea that housing is a commodity, housing should be resolved through property markets and not through state policy. That has become the dominant idea in American political life. And I just think, it's not a real one. I mean, we're at a moment right now, if we think about the migrants or the refugees, the unhoused as one extreme in a broader set of problems regarding housing in the U.S. I mean, I just saw recently where, most Americans, now half of Americans can't even afford to pay, their rent right now. I mean, people are making, tough decisions between, what they're going to eat for dinner, what their kids are going to wear. They're making tough decisions because we know, the rent always eats first, right? Rent has to get paid first. And, the large amount of Americans who can pay are deeply housing or rent burdened, right? So they're paying more than one third and sometimes much more in order to cover the cost of rent and utilities. And so this is a much deeper crisis. I think we have to connect them all together. And it seems that some of the most progressive organizers and activists in Chicago are trying to do that in other places as well. But I just think it's necessary to bring the discussions about the migrants, bring the discussions about the unhoused back into this broader conversation about the patent limitations of housing as a commodity, right? I mean, we can go all the way back to Frederick Engels and the housing question. I mean, one of the arguments that he's making is that this is not a real crisis of capitalism. It is actually how capitalism works. Dispossession is an outcome of, treating housing as a commodity, not as a right, which is what it should be, that we should all have, a place to reproduce ourselves each day, a place where we can have some security and safety from the rest of the world. And so this is a bigger problem. It's a longer standing problem. I think ideologically, a lot of Americans can't really see it because we've all embraced this idea of the house as an aspiration, the house as a way of creating wealth. I mean, even a lot of Black discourse over the last, decade or so, the discussions around reparations, the focus on discrimination in the post-war period, the way people have talked about, Black wealth, it all goes back to this idea that housing should be not only a place where we restore ourselves, reproduce ourselves, but it should also be a means of wealth creation. I mean, this is the core set of American ideological views that has been popularized, like I said, for at least 100 years now. And we need to break free of it. I think this is the moment we should start to cut those ties.
Well, here's a question I have for that, and I'm not, I'll play an honest devil's advocate with that statement, as I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Especially during the deregulated 90s and early 2000s, mm-hmm. It is through financial deregulation that so many Black people do get a small taste for, and brown people as well, of middle class security through not low interest, let's say no income verifying,
right.
Low start rate home loans, right?
High risk.
Yeah, we won't get into all this. That's a whole different show if you want to. And
right,
there's
right.
better books on it that can go into more detail than we could go into in an hour long.
Sure.
But that reality still rings true, even for the children that grew up in the aftermath of 2008. So either you got a small taste of the middle class opulence for a while, like my kids, and then you get the rug pulled from under you, but you understand what that looks like.
Right.
So how do you tell people that that's a bad thing per se?
Because
as someone that's tried to have that conversation, how do you have that conversation with people? It's one thing to say, it sounds nice, and it almost sounds like flowery language, that there's all these wonderful things that are rights, but we all know that there's human rights and your rights are not the same. So shelter is a commodity. And how many black folks do we know that make their living as landlords? It's aspiration, like you said. So how do you tell people that aspiration may not be
right? Yeah, well, so a couple of things. There's a group of people who we will not convince. And I'm not against the idea of people purchasing, you know, homes if that's what they see, you know, as their immediate interest in this moment, right? It's not like the society is changing tomorrow. But I just think there are ways that we can extend housing to a greater number of people. Mm-hmm. And in a way that we cannot do right now in this sort of for-profit single homeowner model, right? It just has not worked. As you point out in the case of the subprime mortgage crisis, it was in reach for a lot of people, but it was in reach in a way that was ultimately disastrous.
Oh.
I just got done teaching, you know, in the last weeks, a section on housing, and we spent a lot of time getting into this process of decommodification and some of the alternatives. There's a couple we can talk about here, oh, you know, if the audience is interested, but, you know, social housing. And so the U.S. failed historically with public housing. We funded it because in the short run, you know, chambers of commerce, building trades, unions, different economic interests within cities supported it because they were in favor of slum clearance. And so were a lot of social reformers who wanted better and safer and more sanitary housing for people. And so it was a short run coalition that brought us public housing across the country. But ultimately, right, we didn't support it. We didn't fund it at the national level in a way that would have sustained it, primarily because people thought it was a communist idea, right? It went against the grain of how, you know, at that time, people are promoting housing as a economic commodity, as a way of building wealth, as a way of creating a nation of nominal property owners, right? So one thing we could do, right, is we could reinvent the notion of public housing, maybe more along the lines as they've done in places like Austria, right? And I mean, Austria's housing is not what it was in an earlier period where it was state run and state managed. Now they've moved to a model that involves still some private investment, you know, whether it's construction companies or architects, but there's a heavy state influence in what happens. And there's much more in the way of the goal of creating communities. And I think that's one of the things we got away from when we tried to do public housing here. Most people didn't care about the community that existed there from the very beginning. I mean, there may have been some different amenities put in place, but if you look at the Austrian model by comparison, I mean, what they've done essentially is that there's subsidization from the state in at least three different ways. There's land grants that happen. So you're situating social housing in places that are oftentimes prime real estate in gentrifying areas, in, you know, on waterfronts, right? So it's not like you're doing as we did in the U.S. with public housing. You put, you know, the tower in the garden somewhere else off the highway, away from the surrounding urban fabric. And so there's much more intentional integration of these new housing complexes. There's also much more in the way of public participation in what happens. I mean, even to the point of tenants being able to partially design the units that they're going to occupy. There's much more focus on integrating different kinds of people within the life cycle. And so retirees, as well as, you know, families with small children, students, professionals, people on lower incomes. And so there's a tendency to try to integrate different kinds of people and to make sure that over time, these people remain in place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another one of those investments that happens, I mean, is the support in terms of how the construction happens, right? The state is also involved in it. But then on the other side, there's subsidies to help with the paying of the rent once people are in the units. And so multiple layers state investment, as opposed to what we did, which was to build something and then really pull away federal support and expect those buildings to survive over the long haul. You know, complexes like the Pruitt-Igoe homes in St. Louis, or, you know, Taylor, Cabrini Green here in Chicago, right? We expected those places to survive on the tenants' incomes and the tenants' rents, which was already inadequate, right? So how would you allow those massive complexes to be maintained on that low of a budget, right? And without federal support. And so I think we could do things differently. Another example that we need to revisit, and I strongly encourage everybody to take a look at a documentary that's available online. It's really short. It's not like a fancy, you know, cinematic wonder. It's a basic, straightforward story of Co-op City in the Bronx, you know, northernmost reaches of the Bronx. Mm-hmm. Co-op City remains the largest cooperative housing complex in the world right now. And it was one of dozens of cooperative complexes that were built across New York City. And we saw the, you know, this is heavy union involvement, right? Unions and other progressives were involved in building these complexes. And, you know, what you end up with in this case is a situation where, you know, there's more in the way of ownership, right? And more collective ownership. It's not the, you know, the privatized model. And it was actually designed as a way of helping people who weren't eligible for public housing, but they also could not aspire to the Levittown, you know, single family home model, right? And so it met people who were kind of in the middle, like nominal homeowners. And it was also progressive racially. This is something that we should remember. We should say it every time somebody tries to trash, you know, the American left as, you know, always white and super racist. There were provisions in places like Co-op City to make sure that in the beginning there was at least 20% minority occupants. And there was a moment when, you know, in terms of the governing of Co-op City, it was dominated mostly by white and Jewish residents. And they actually stepped back and said, this is a problem, and tried to figure out a way to bring about more representation of Black and brown people. You look at Co-op City today, and it's overwhelmingly working class, but I think somewhere around the neighborhood of about 70% Black and Latino. And so, you know, it again, it still survives. It has some of the lowest crime rates, lower than the rest of the boroughs. And so this is possible. It's doable. We can figure out ways to bring, you know, quality housing within reach of people. It should not be based on the single family model, which is also ecologically disastrous, right? It's inefficient to have so many different, you know, palatial and irrational, you know, small single family homes all around the country, right? A lot of these places are empty, especially as people age up. And so there's other models that we can use. I saw somebody in the chat mention community land trust. That's another one that we could talk about as well. But I just think these are ways of, you know, again, creating opportunities or possibilities for people to have housing, to have a home, without necessarily relying on this strictly for-profit, private ownership model. And so I'm excited about the possibilities. I think people are having these conversations again. And it will be interesting now that, you know, in Chicago, we're talking about the redistributive dimension of all of this. Mm-hmm. If we could also add to that some solutions that don't just, you know, rehash the same old things we've heard before, tiny houses and all sorts of other things that people have proposed when it comes to housing, you know, the homeless, right? There's other ways we can approach this.
I'm not the biggest tiny house fan, to be honest with you. I am.
You say you are?
I'm not. No. No. It's like, well, you go live in one for 5 minutes and you tell me how great of a fucking idea it is. Or I just
tough heard. Shed. You don't want to have a
oh, tough do you shed. Have tough sheds in Chicago? You guys have tough sheds in Chicago?
They sell them all over, right?
No, do you have tough shed communities in Chicago, like in the Bay Area?
Well, you know what? Here's a great example. They were building some. Mm-hmm. They had partnered with some students at Illinois Tech to build some. Mm-hmm. And they were dismantled this week, right? They were dismantled, you know, and kind of along the same lines, there were migrants who were evicted from some of the centers where they were this past week.
You know, Oakland, the Bay Area has such a large homeless population, and it has kind of scattered out into the hinterlands of California. But the bulk of it remains in the urban core, right? I was just up there a little bit ago visiting family. I was in San Francisco. And more so in the East Bay, because I feel like there's a little more space there. You see these tough shit, and you don't see them, because they usually put a fence up so high that you can't see.
Right. That's how it was in L.A.
Well, okay, yeah, I forgot you lived in L.A. for a minute. So yeah, you know L.A. has one in Highland Park.
It was one in Highland Park.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that, because what we're talking about here, and this is going to sound really disgusting, is disposable people.
Right.
People that don't contribute to the economy, people that are disabled in some way, shape, or form, usually. So there's a lot of storage.
Right.
And when your first idea for a human is, oh, what about that place where I keep my tools? You can put fucking old Henry in there, right? He's fine. He doesn't give a damn. He was on the sidewalk yesterday.
Right.
If I've never been around people in those rooms that make those decisions, I wouldn't talk like this.
Yeah.
So I'm not a fan of that solution, so to speak. I do like what you're saying about thinking communally, because it is something that is lost in the kind of, when people say McMansion, I think they think of the 80s suburb build out and the 70s suburb build out, but we forget the 90s and 2000s suburb build out, where it was like, well, we have way more money to deal with because all this credit is interest free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you start saying, well, F2 cars, I want a 3-car garage. And we need 4,000 square feet of living space, and everywhere needs to be gated. And I want a moat. Right. You know? Yeah. I've met so many people with moats. But switching a little bit from an article where you were featured in Southside Weekly. In January, CBS2 reported that between December 2022 and January 2024, the city, we're talking about Chicago here, spent $156.2 million supporting asylum seekers. The Sun-Times reported in December that $95 million of that was reallocated from unspent COVID-19 relief funds in 2023. That is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't Negroes be upset about hearing these figures? How is the mayor handling this? And what do you think is wrong with this kind of messaging?
You know, the mayor, you know, I've been a huge fan since the very beginning. And I was excited. I mean, there's some, you know, different podcasts I was on and talks I gave all over where I was pretty much, you know, jubilant about the mayor's election. And I didn't have any illusions about what he was up against. I just didn't imagine that it would happen so rapidly, that the first crisis he would face would come from outside the city. But what wasn't surprising was the reaction from local politicians. I mean, one thing that's important to know about Chicago, and this might help to explain a lot of the reaction to the mayor, there's been a long time tension between the approach to governing, right? The dominant approach, of course, has been, and for a long time, was patron clientelism, right? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, you support certain candidates and there's a heavy, you know, system of reward and punishment, you know, for people who are, you know, people are disciplined. If they don't support somebody, they're rewarded with all sorts of different benefits if they do. And it's so ingrained into the city. I mean, one thing I despise about Chicago, and I'm saying this as a person who considers himself a Chicagoan and I love it as a place. One thing I dislike is how locals talk about, you know, BYOB. Restaurants, right? They talk about it with a certain kind of affection. When you go to a restaurant and it's like, oh, it's BYOB, and they get excited about it, not knowing that this is, or maybe just not caring, that this has to do with a longer history of patronage when it comes to the assignment and rewarding of
liquor licenses.
Awarding of liquor licenses, right? And so, you know, I grew up in Louisiana. You can buy hard liquor from like a gas station, right? It's like, it's unheard of that you would go to a restaurant and unless they've done something wrong, you should be able to buy whatever you want from there. I should be able to buy a drink or cocktail in a restaurant, not have to bring a bottle in with me. But in Chicago, it's almost a part of the culture that some people look forward to it. They look forward to bringing their own bottles. And, you know, in my mind, this is just a marker of political dysfunction over the years, right? So when you look at the reaction to the mayor and the migrant crisis and this idea that somehow Black people are being cut out of the deal. What's missing is the very, you know, the very truth that a lot of these older persons haven't done shit, right? They're literally like do nothing, you know, older persons. I mean, they can point to specific divisible benefits, right? Like maybe pocket parks and summer jobs and things like that. But that's like, again, that's the old style of Chicago politics and not what's needed, which is a politics that's more based on policy making, right? You know, addressing the city's problems, coalition building beyond the next election and beyond your own, you know, fiefdom of an aldermanic district. And so I just think it's a weird place in that regard. And there's a growing contingent of socialists and social democratic politicians who've been elected, you know, as older persons. But when you look at the South Side, right, and the West Sides, I mean, there's a really entrenched and longstanding tradition of, you know, again, patron clientelism, which is not a progressive politics at all. It could never be, right? It is actually the antithesis of that. And it's very much about, you know, worrying about the not just the district that they're elected from, but worrying about their own self-preservation. And we see that most clearly. I mean, a great example of this and probably the most transparently terrible example is Anthony Beale, right? Anthony Beale represents the Ninth Ward of the city, which includes, I think, part of Pullman, the historic Pullman area, as well as Roseland. And these are areas with high levels of poverty, you know, not much in the way of economic development. And he was one of the loudest voices criticizing the mayor and calling out this attention to refugees versus the local Black population. And it's just so disingenuous. I mean, this is a guy who got into a scandal a few years back because he, you know, I guess twisted the arm of a local principal at a selective school to make sure his kid could get into that school, right? And he was exposed. So this is somebody who's been in office for a long time. He doesn't really have a whole lot to point to in terms of success. I mean, one of the things that I read about that he had done was he somehow had passed legislation that made certain Black parts of the city dry, you know, dry districts, essentially. And so this, again, is like the moral, you know, moral repression as somehow an advance, right? Let's take away liquor stores from Black neighbors because that's the problem. And not the kind of underdevelopment, which I could see somebody like Beale also supporting all sorts of mega projects at the same time he's pushing for, you know, dry districts in Black parts of the city. And so it's hypocrisy, it's short-sightedness, it's the lack of vision. And it unfortunately, it allows people like him to flourish. It was also rumored that a lot of his loud reaction to Brandon Johnson was really about his own, you know, desire to run for mayor, you know, and maybe tasting the blood in the water, so to speak, that Johnson was in trouble and was being attacked by a lot of people for what was happening. And so all of a sudden, you know, it's the opportune time to call him out. But, you know, African-Americans aren't the only ones who've opposed Johnson on this issue. There's also been some pretty strong opposition coming from, you know, parts of Chinatown, Bridgeport, and Brighton Park, where Chinese Americans have also, you know, pushed back against the idea of siting a relocation center for migrants in Brighton Park. And so a lot of that money came from business persons, right? It wasn't like true grassroots. It was very much, I guess, kind of like a astroturf movement of sorts. But just old fashioned NIMBY politics, like we don't want it here. We don't want it in our neighborhood. Right. So, you know, it's odd. It's tragic. It's terrible to watch as it's unfolding. But in many ways, it's predictable. And, you know, unfortunately, Brandon Johnson was able to win the electoral battle to become mayor of the city of Chicago. But we should stay sober. Right. Chicago is not governed by the mayor. Chicago is governed by a broader regime of, you know, different blocks of capital that aren't even located in the city in many cases. So real estate interests, major multinational corporations that are cited here, you know, all sorts of different tourism and entertainment interests, as well as even all industrial, you know, interests that still remain in the city, either in production, right, still producing things. Mm-hmm. We still have massive steel mills just to the south of the city. We still have automotive manufacturing happening up in the northwestern region of northern Illinois. And we have all sorts of other smaller scale production happening. So those interests are what matters in this city. And I think Brandon Johnson is an important figure for us, but we shouldn't fool ourselves to think that somehow he's in control when you have all those other, you know, blocks of capital that are, you know, that are concerned about what happens here. Last thing I'll say about that is that Chicago remains one of the most powerful cities in the world in terms of the economy, right? Its economic might. It's not a huge city compared to global standards, right? I mean, it's not even in the top 25, I don't think, when it comes to populations. But when you look at its domestic, you know, sort of share of GDP, it's larger than many cities that are like 10 times its size, right? And so I just think it's important to keep that in mind, right? I mean, it's still a powerful place, an important node within the global capitalist economy, and exercises influence beyond its numbers. And that's tough for a left-leaning mayor to manage, right? You know, a city that is only about 2.7 million, mm-hmm. but yet is ranked in the top 10 when it comes to global cities. I think this is a tough balance to have to deal with.
So do you have, you sounds like you have some sympathy for young Brandon Johnson?
I mean, I do. I guess I'm more angry about his team. I mean, the people around him, right? You know, where the people who are not in the limelight, whose job it is to think, you know, not to give speeches, but to actually think about what happens next. Mm-hmm. There's also something puzzling. I've been mulling this around for a while. There's also a puzzling dimension to this. If, for people who can remember 20 years ago when the Katrina disaster happened, right? Mm-hmm. You know, all of these different charitable groups were tripping over themselves, right? Mm-hmm. In the weeks, months, and years after the disaster to try to help people. I mean, you know, Katrina evacuees were spread to the entire country. I think pretty much every state in the union, maybe even every zip code at one time or another had hosted one, at least one Katrina evacuee. And people rolled out the red carpet for the short term. I mean, provided folks with, you know, housing and jobs and all sorts of different, you know, forms of support, you know, got kids integrated into schools as much as they could, right? Open the doors. Colleges, you know, brought people in, brought on students, you know, helped them get situated. Why don't we see something similar in this case? I mean, I understand that asylum seeking is a different process, right? In some cases, some of these people are going to be denied their application for asylum. But where's the, we don't even see the same reaction, right? It's like completely different.
Well, do you
think completely different?
Well, do you think it has anything to do? How can I put this? I'm a big believer in the power of media, mm-hmm. which sounds ridiculous as we talk on this show, but you know, we exist. We're not journalists in the sense of, you know, Pascal and I aren't breaking stories. MT's not gone because she's got a pencil behind her ear interviewing someone, right? We're more critics of the news and we try to talk about more evergreen things. Mm-hmm. That being said, if you think about the way that was portrayed mm-hmm. as lost people and a tragedy,
right?
And then our great black filmmakers, and I do say that with a bit of a tongue implanted in my cheek, like Spike Lee, do these kind of homages. Kanye West, for a lot of people, gets this activist bona fides because he says George Bush doesn't care about black people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we look at Katrina as a mishandling by the bungler in chief, mm-hmm. who at the time was Bush Jr. And again, this is just my opinion. And I was in Louisiana not long after Katrina. So I heard the horror stories. I heard the horror stories from people that had to go back to work after retiring because of the outside contractors that came in and said, oh, yeah, we fixed your house. It's fine. And you get there and your house is still, it's just a foundation because they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know people are probably separated by less than 6 degrees from people like that. And I remember the stories about people that moved to Houston and how Houston got flooded with all this crime because they had all these Ninth Ward people in their hood. And the Boondocks did a whole episode of getting my FEMA check. I think it's one way to look at it as, yeah, we were resourceful for a minute. Mm-hmm. But the longer story, as these things play out, the good story is only going to last so long in the media cycle because it's the negative one that gets us fired up.
Right.
And, you know, we would get the New Orleans newspaper in. And I remember seeing some of those headlines, the Picayune. I'm probably saying it totally wrong.
Mm-hmm, that's it. Times Picayune.
Yeah. And it didn't last that long. The love affair with, and let's call them migrants, didn't last that long. And there's a disassociation with Black people in major cities of being migrants. Mm-hmm. Most of us have family that came from the South. My grandparents on my father's side are from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
They're not from California. I'm not 10 generations deep in California or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like most other people I grew up with. But we don't look at our family as refugees from Jim Crow.
Right.
Maybe you can have some empathy if you try to see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember kind of the backlash of the Katrina refugees, which it almost feels like it's something that we want to forget as a nation, that horrible, you know, what happened to those people, what they lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, you're from the area, so you know better than anybody how devastating that thing was. I think images are important. And I think one thing that happened with migrants is there was a moment in 2018 to 2020 where everyone's heart bled. I remember I worked a festival in El Paso and there were throngs of people going down there to donate everything because you saw these kids and they were so dirty and they're in these pens and everybody wanted to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares anymore. Mm-hmm. The narrative changed because of the reporting. And now that's the only lens in which we understand this problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's, again, this is just my opinion. I don't know if you.
No, I agree. I mean, I think the different context, I was throwing it out to be, you know, not to be not just for the sake of discussion, but as a comparison, right? I think different contexts. And I think, you know, one immediate response to my own, you know, provocation is I think that the contemporary example gives us a sense of how powerful the xenophobic rhetoric is, right?
You know,
and there are a lot of people here who've expressed that. You know, I've heard people, not just the Anthony Beals, but like people on the street, folks on public transit who also have anti-immigrant sentiments. I think also, you know, unlike earlier waves of American migrants, especially if you think about the Cold War, where, you know, we embraced, you know, different groups, whether it was, you know, Cubans, Cambodians, Vietnamese, you know, Laotians, other folks, right? The idea was that these people are being persecuted by, you know, these terrible communist regimes, and therefore they should be able to have safe haven. I think that rhetoric doesn't prevail, even in the case of Venezuelans who might claim that they're fleeing, you know,
Maduro's communism.
Right. It doesn't really land in the same ways now as it might have, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And so I think that's one of the problems. But I think another issue is, you know, many Americans are hurting, right? That might be one way to think about it as well. And so what do we have to give, you know, more broadly, right? I mean, like I said earlier, many people can't pay their rent. And here, I mean, it's ubiquitous everywhere, on every corner, at every shopping, you know, strip mall, at every Home Depot, you'll see you know, people either panhandling, men congregating, you know, looking for work. I mean, it's a highly visible population in the city. And they're in addition to all the other, you know, homeless encampments and panhandlers and other people we had in the city before. And so I think, you know, it's a different moment, but I think it's a moment that offers a set of possibilities for us to begin to talk about these issues differently, right? We don't have to talk about them as completely separate. You know, that was one of the things that was frustrating about living in Los Angeles, was having people talk as if the problem of homelessness, you know, or the unhoused, whatever your preference might be as far as terminology, that their problem is somehow distinct and cut off from that of those persons who are living in RVs all over Los Angeles County, right? Or people like I knew who couldn't live in Los Angeles County without having a roommate. I mean, so many people I knew, they had roommates. They either had boarders,
yeah,
and they had other roommates who were their age, you know, cohorts who they were renting with, or they had, you know, intergenerational families where, you know, people are living together in order to be able to make ends meet. And so we have to think about these issues together, right? I mean, otherwise we slide into, you know, blame labeling the desperately poor, thinking that somehow their plight is different. We're all pretty much a few rents away from, you know, people who are sleeping on under the overpass. I mean, this is the reality that we're in right now. And again, you know, many Americans are feeling that. Most people cannot afford, you know, once they pay their rent, to do basic things. And so I just think we're at an important moment. And the craziest part about it is that neither one of these political parties at the national level is trying to do anything to staunch the bleeding. And so, you know, it's not even entering into the conversation. I mean, on the one side, from the Democrats and from Biden, we're hearing unwavering support for Israel and, you know, the Gaza genocide. And on the other side, you know, not much more, right? I mean, really just the same obscene claims. I mean, even the Democrats, you know, are like essentially pinning most of their hopes on a reelection of Biden on the possible conviction and banning of Trump from the election in some way. And I don't think that's going to happen. So I just think it's just a sad situation we're in, where it's not coming from the parties at the national level. Neither candidate is treating questions of housing as a central concern. But Biden has kind of danced around the issue of debt relief. You know, he's done it for certain groups, or like with limited limitations on it, you know, those who are still owing student loans. But I just don't see it coming from those places, right? And I think, you know, from either one of those parties, I think it's places like Chicago, it's places like LA, it's places like the Bay Area, where you already have certain forces in motion who can push for different kinds of experiments and perhaps achieve, you know, not only immediate, you know, policies or programs that can benefit people on the ground, but might also provide us with a demonstration that could be scaled upwards. And so that's where my hope is. I mean, you know, most days I'm not too optimistic, and I've actually stopped watching, you know, a lot of mainstream news because of that. But I just think that it's in these local areas where we already have forces amassed that we might actually be able to make some advances. You know, that's where we have to build from.
We had a super chat here on the screen. I think I missed it. Give me a second. I'll pull it up. Can you talk to the idea of migrants as a reflection of our own failure to deal with climate crisis and our oncoming future?
Yeah. I mean, I just think we're going to see more and more of this, right?
Yeah. Wait till we see a bunch of people in Gaza. I mean, it's not over yet.
Right. And I think I would say, you know, climate crisis is one dimension of it. But some of this is, you know, it's American destabilization, right, in these places. Right. I mean, we've you know, from a strictly economic vantage point, I mean, we've over the last, you know, 30, 40 years created a context where, you know, some of the protections that might have been in place for people, right? Some of the nominal social safety nets, you know, within this hemisphere, in the southern part of the hemisphere, that might have been in place. Some of the basic infrastructures that might have been in place to serve the local populations, we've gutted those, right? We've opened them up to, you know, unregulated capitalist class power, and it's created destabilization. It's created a tremendous amount of misery, and it's no wonder that people are trying to flee those places, right? I mean, we would as well if we're in a place where, you know, you're completely dominated by, you know, either politicians or gangs, or politicians and their gangs, right? So, you know, it's no wonder that people would, you know, in Haiti or in, you know, different parts of Latin America would, you know, throw caution to the wind and, you know, take a harrowing journey north towards the United States, right? I mean, but in a way, you know, we're the ones who helped to, and I say we as in, as a nation, right? We're the ones who have helped to create some of those conditions, right? Whether it's, you know, ecological problems, whether it's political instability, whether it's the hollowing out of infrastructure, or, you know, just the mass immiseration that comes from weakening the, you know, the wage systems in some of these other parts of the other hemisphere. I mean, I just think we've created some of these conditions, or northern-based capital, U.S.-based capital has created these conditions. And we can expect to see more of it, right? I mean, we can expect to see more instability, more mass migration in the foreseeable future if, you know, we don't figure out ways to reverse the problems of, you know, capitalist globalization and you know, neoliberalization in some of these other regions that are adjacent to the United States.
Well, I hope that answers your question. We have one last super chat, very serious one, from TIR supporter Dizzle McFizzle. Dizzle asks, also, what's the guest's opinion on the hoes of all genders? Loyal, not loyal. Explain. Basically, he's asking you, are these hoes loyal?
Right. It depends on who are the hoes, right?
I think he means the hoes in the city government of Chicago. Are these hoes loyal?
Not at all. Not at all, right? You know, and there's no strong hand to bring them back in line. In the case of Chicago, for sure.
Very pimpy response there. We appreciate that response.
Right, right.
It's very pimpy and appropriate.
Yeah, it's bad here. I think, yeah, I mean, and yet, of all the places I've lived, I'm more optimistic about the possibilities here. I've lived in some pretty corrupt states, some corrupt parts of this country, right? I've lived in New York State. Right, I've lived in Louisiana. Right, I've lived inside the Beltway. So,
Jesus.
Right. I think I have I've been on a corruption tour for the last, you know, 50 plus years. So, still, despite the legendary, you know, problems here in Illinois, there's forces that are gathering. Right, there's forces that are in motion here. And again, you know, seeing that ballot referendum there today, I just think it's evidence that, you know, there's some people here who think that we can organize in a way that redistributes wealth and figures out a way to address some of the problems that we have, right? And I mean, I think this referendum can be really important, you know, if it's not passed this time, the next time around, given that Chicago has three different mega projects in motion right now. And these are, like, you know, I would encourage people to take a look at them. They're literally an attempt to build brand new neighborhoods pretty much from scratch. There's one called the 78, which is very close to where I am right now, which has been a vacant lot as long as I've been here, vacant parcel of land next to the Chicago River. And now the Chicago White Sox are talking about building their stadium there, along with a host of, you know, condo towers.
Well, you know,
new subway stop, all of the things that you pull together, right?
You spent 5 minutes in the Bay Area before. Right. I don't know if you ever came here before Pac Bell Park, and I don't know what it's called now. It's called Pac Bell Park to me. But that was nothing.
Yeah.
Right? That was kind of the hood.
Right.
They built that stadium, and now it's waterfront property and multimillion-dollar houses. And all you hear is people talk about how wonderful it is to have this glorious, these glorious buildings there. I mean, the new Warrior Stadium is right over there as well.
Right.
So when you say things like the White Sox are talking about moving.
And they're talking about moving like not even 4 miles. it's like literally across the.
And this is the Bears. So I'm going to say this is the Bears. So it's the Bears too. This is the Bears' new stadium as well. They're going to
go. The Bears are also going to try to build a lakefront stadium.
Look, man, and I'm not. We did a whole show about the folly of stadiums.
Right.
Not a fan. But you start saying things like jobs to people, and they just assume that every job is going to be an executive for the team and not that clown selling, you know.
Selling bad spot. Beer.
Yes. Bootleg White Sox shirt. Bootleg Taylor Swift shirts at the concert.
Yeah, I mean.
Like, it's not. When you see what happened to San Francisco, they built an apartment building where the Warriors play. A gorgeous apartment building, right? There was a unit they had for low-income housing.
Right.
One. You know, it's not what people think it's going to be.
Mm-mm.
You get to watch your game in a nicer place, but sometimes you can't afford to go to that game.
Right. I just had a conversation about this. I don't know how we're looking on time, but I had a conversation with some students about this class of stadiums that were built like in the 1920s,
mm-hmm.
right? The LA Coliseum.
Yep.
Soldier Field. Mm-hmm. The Rose Bowl in Pasadena.
Beautiful.
Stanford Stadium. They're all kind of the same sorts of bowl stadiums. And those were built, I think oftentimes the seating was bench seating. And I've been to, you know, I was at a game. I was at the Rose Bowl when I was there. And, you know, there's not a bad seat in the house, right? But that these old sort of classical style built for the masses, but they were built before the NFL, you know, and collegiate football becomes the massive, you know, profit-making machinery it is now. And so, you know, the perfect example, maybe the most grotesque example is what they did to Soldier Field. They took the stadium that was the stadium of Gale Sayers and, you know, Walter Payton and the 85 Bears, you know, and they basically put like a deck on top of it, a couple of decks. And that was done not for aesthetic reasons. It was done primarily to, you know, to meet the new tiered ticketing structures mm-hmm. of the NFL, right? Where it's no longer about that kind of like mass thing where the steel worker and the elevator operator and, you know, every high school kid who can get money from their parent goes to the ball game, right? It's actually more about this fan experience that is about round the clock consumerism, right? Yes. Where you're being bombarded with not only all sorts of different merch choices, but various food options and, you know, other kinds of experiences to take photographs and to, you know, pretend that you can throw, you know, you can kick a field goal, all sorts of things like that. Right. So
mm-hmm.
it's all about a different kind of consumer experience that is more, you know, suited to our times. And it really is a violation of what those earlier stadiums were built for. And aesthetically, those are just much more gorgeous places to be in. They just feel different. A lot of old American baseball parks were like that, where, you know, it was an intimacy to those stadiums. I mean, I don't particularly like Wrigleyville and what it stands for, but if you go to Wrigley Field, you do get that kind of old ballpark feel, kind of pre, you know, mass extremely television. Right, yeah. Absolutely.
Television changes everything.
Absolutely, right? But like now, I mean, you think about the stadium they're going to build for the Bears. It's all about the investment and what, how many mega events can they hold in that stadium. They're thinking already about Super Bowls and about
Olympics,
whatever else they can host. The next tournament.
Taylor right? Swift concert. You
right,
know?
Exactly. Look, exactly. Right?
I remember the last time I worked at EDC, which is a great big music festival. I think at the time it was the biggest in North America. I don't know if anything's bigger than it. It was about 175,000 people a day.
Mm.
And the people that I was working for the food and beverage company. And I'm in the office. It's a nightmare because I'm not the biggest fan of electronic dance music at 4 a.m. in a metal room where it's just, it doesn't stop, right?
Right.
And one of the managers has been up, you know, even later than me. And he's like, you know, and it was the year that the hockey team in Vegas made it to the Stanley Cup, I believe. And it was just such a boon financially. Mm. You're like, man, we're getting the Raiders too?
Mm.
It was like game over. You know, Vegas is holding it down. And everybody wants to build the next, they call Vegas the Death Star.
Right.
This massive multi-billion dollar complex with, like you said, all the accoutrements of a capitalist paradise where you can consume and pay for every experience possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes something that the casual fan really wants.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to draw demarcating lines between who can enjoy this stuff and who can't. And I don't think we have that conversation enough, especially in sports spaces. I forget if you're a little bit of a sports fan. I don't think you're not that big, right?
No, I'm pretty heavy into sports.
Like, I appreciate you lying on me.
I'm pretty heavy into it. I get lulled into it.
But are you a Saints guy or are you a Bears guy now?
Totally a Saints fan. I mean, I can try to cheer for the Bears, but there's not a whole lot to cheer.
Hey, one thing I will say is working in the Gulf with you Saints fans, like, these are real sports fans, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, right.
You gotta be
long suffering.
But you know, that stadium hasn't changed. And I don't really hear too much about people wanting a new one. You can remodel it if you want, but
people hated that thing when it was built.
I mean, it's kind of ugly.
Yeah,
it's just right there in the middle.
They literally said it was like a spaceship landed in downtown. You know?
That's exactly what it was. Right. Yeah. But, you know, people think about Detroit and they go, well, what about what the new Ford Field did for Detroit? It's like, well, I don't know. It's just kind of nice around there. And the rest of it is still like, ugh.
I just think, like, you know, like if you think about it, like the Superdome, for instance, right? It was damaged in Katrina. You know, there was a moment when the Benson family threatened to move. They were talking about moving the team.
If you let them people in, those people.
Yeah, and they were going to move the team because they wanted the state to really pay for, you know, remodeling the stadium, repairing the stadium. And in the end, I mean, they got such a sweetheart deal. Like the state actually gave them a building. There was a high-rise building that had been a hotel at one point. I remember going there when I was a kid for Bayou Classic. But they basically donated this building to the team. I think subsidized some of the remodeling of this building.
Jesus.
And then the state actually moved all of its government offices into the building and gave the Benson family a guaranteed set of tenants.
Wow.
You know, so it was like a sweetheart deal. They also, I think, said a lot of other remodeling around, you know, the arena, actually two arenas, because they built the Smoothie King arena for the Pelicans, right? Which also was owned by the Benson family. So they got this sweetheart deal. I just remember feeling deeply conflicted about it, right? Because the Saints meant a lot to, you know, Louisiana sports fans. But this was one of those moments where it's like, where are the priorities, right? We're demolishing public housing. And at the same time, we're heavily subsidizing private sector development. That's not going to benefit most New Orleanians in a really substantial way other than, you know, the connection or affinity they have for a sports franchise. And I just think, like, again, bringing it back home to the question of housing of migrants, housing of the unhoused, housing of Americans who are struggling to pay their rent. When do we begin to have people in the streets, people who are upset about these priorities, right? It's kind of like we witnessed this over and over, one city after another, massive subsidies in order to support, you know, in order to support these stadium construction. And yet, you know, a discussion about housing, you know, for people just can't get any traction. It's just one of those things where we just do not, we do not have a way of approaching it, right? And thinking about it in a critical way and talking about it in a way that gets, you know, most Americans not only upset, but just activated and, you know, in motion. So.
Well, I'm hoping for that kind of conversation, maybe return to 2020 shelter in place conversations. That was the last time I've heard people have any sort of empathetic ear to real substantive housing for unhoused citizens. Before we go, David Epps has a question for you, Grambling or Southern?
It's not even a question, man. Come on. Southern University all day, all night, all times. Come on. Never a question.
Well, thank you very much, Cedric, for taking some time to talk to me. I'm glad we got to do this. I am trying to have the big Black people panel because mm-hmm. Paul Prescott wrote a paper on something you wrote a book about, the Gary Convention of 1972.
Oh, yeah.
So at the end of the month, if you're free, Teray's already in, Prescott's already in. We're going to have a fun discussion of what happened to the Black Revolution.
All right.
If you're down, but you have to wear those glasses.
I will. I can even drive down to Gary and stand on the check cashing center. Broadcast from the spot.
This is what happened. So thank you, Cedric, very much. Have a very good evening and keep us posted what's going on in Chicago, because I find it a very telling situation for our current political moment.
Absolutely.
I say look no further than Chicago and possibly the Bay Area. But have a very good night. I kept you too long. Thank you very much.
Sure. That's enough. Good to be here.
His name is Cedric Johnson. Always a pleasure to have him on the show. If you didn't know, pretty much the reason why there's a Pascal in the show, you can link it right to Cedric Johnson, because Cedric Johnson brought Teray on. Teray brought Pascal. So there's direct link. So he's always a very important person in the TIR universe. So I'm really hoping that he's able to join us for the show. Is it next week? Yeah, next Saturday we're going to do it. So that'll be a fun time. So thank you, guys. There should be a link already up in the champagne room. We can continue this discussion if you like in the champagne room. We could be a little serious in there if you like. I don't mind, because it's just me and y'all. And I like y'all. So if you are listening on Apple and you want to hear the champagne room shenanigans, subscribe. It's as easy as that. If you're watching the show and you want to hear the champagne room shenanigans, past and present, become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. And on that note, we are out.